The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Goldstein's unable to make it tonight. He had business where he had to go to Korea on a moment's notice. He says his regret, but infinitely more importantly, he sends Kevin Russell in his place. Let me give you a quick intro and Kevin that we can get started on the workshop. Mr. Russell is a partner at Howe & Russell, one of the preeminent appellate litigation firms. During the 2005 Supreme Court term, he was counsel or co-counsel on five merit cases, as well as helped write numerous petitions for cert. Prior to joining the firm, Kevin worked in the appellate section of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. During that time, he represented the United States in more than 35 civil and criminal cases in front of 11 federal courts of appeals, presenting oral arguments in more than two dozen of those cases. Before working at the U.S. Department of Justice, Kevin clerked for Justice Stephen Breyer during the Supreme Court October term of 1995, and he also clerked for William A. Norris of the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Ninth Circuit. He's a graduate of Yale Law School and a member of the Maryland and District of Columbia Bars. Please help me welcome Kevin Russell.
Tom does send his apologies. I know he very much wanted to come and meet with you all. He's very proud of this law school and his connection with it. The reason you're stuck with me is, as I'm sure many of you know, that Tom started his Supreme Court career by founding his own law firm, Goldstein & Howe, and I was a partner there until Tom left us last May, at which point we became Howe & Russell, and Tom started his Supreme Court practice over at Aiken. So I've had a connection with Tom for a while now. I know well enough that you should be disappointed that you're stuck with me and not him. But I'm going to do my best. I've tried to put this together rather quickly. And what I am going to principally do is talk to you about appellate advocacy, principally in the Supreme Court, because that's what I understand the moot court is targeted at. I'm going to try to use as much as possible actual examples from Supreme Court arguments. We have a very nice resource, the OEA's project at the Supreme Court hosts the audio and transcripts of a lot of Supreme Court arguments, which I would recommend to you if you're looking for examples of very good and also very poor Supreme Court arguments that can be very instructive for you. I would encourage you, as I'm going through this tonight, to stop me and ask questions. As is true at oral arguments, I tend to do better when I'm responding to questions than when I'm speechifying, and I'm sure that's true of many of you as well. So I would very much invite this to be a little more interactive than the actual physical setting would seem to invite. I think what I'd like to do is start off by talking for a few minutes about where your case is at once you get to the point of oral argument. Because I think it's important to understand what's gone on ahead of time so you have some idea of where the justices are coming at when they're coming to sit down and listen to you at oral argument. As you're well aware, before oral argument, the Supreme Court has already taken a look at the case twice, once at the cert stage where the court has principally focused on whether this is a case that's presenting a question that it should be reviewing. But as part of that analysis, the court has looked at the merits, that the parties have briefed the merits ordinarily in their cert petitions, and that's been the subject of a cert pool memo by clerks within the court. It's been read by all the justices. The justices have discussed the case at their conference before they voted to grant cert. And then after granting cert, of course, there's been briefing on the merits. It's typical of most of the chambers, and I believe, in fact, all of them except Justice Stevens' chambers, to have the clerks write extensive bench memos in preparation for oral argument, which can run 30 to 50 pages long, which summarize the contents and the arguments in the briefs on the merits, present the clerk's view of the proper disposition of the case, and frequently contains the results of the clerk's own independent research beyond the briefs. The justices themselves will have read all the principal briefs, at least. Many of them will read all of them. Sometimes if there's a lot of amicus briefs, the justices may rely on their clerks to pick and choose the most important ones. But they will be intimately familiar with the arguments in the briefs, both from having read them and from the bench memos. And And then the third thing you need to keep in mind is that the justices are going to be prepared within a very few days after the argument to vote on the disposition of the case. Now, that vote is never completely dispositive. Justices can change their mind after they've read the draft opinions, but that actually rarely happens. All of which is simply to emphasize that by the time you get to oral arguments, the court has done most of the thinking that it's going to do about the case already. Justice Breyer, when he was out promoting his most recent book, was asked by a journalist how often oral argument actually affects the outcome of his decision. And I think it's worth reading his response to you. He said, quote, "You're rarely uncertain." This is as of our oral argument. "As soon as I read a question, I have a view. But the fact is, at the earlier stages of a case, although I have a view, I'm very open to changing my mind. Over time, you become less and less willing to change your mind. For example, the old joke is that you read the petitioner's brief, you say, that they're right. You read the respondent's brief, you say, they're right. And somebody says, they can't both be right, and you say, they're right. So I go into oral argument almost always with a view, but quite often I'll change it. How often? Maybe 15 or 20% of the time. But more often than actually changing the outcome, it might change what I think is important, how to characterize it, what the arguments are, and sometimes really it will be radically different. So the lesson is that most of the time when you're going before a court, most of the justices will have made up their mind. Some of them will have lingering doubts about certain aspects of the case, and once in a while, a couple of them will be truly open to persuasion. Your ability to change the outcome of the case, therefore, is limited, but it's limited in a special way. That is, it's limited principally in your ability to allay the justices' lingering concerns about your position at the margins, about the extent of the rule that you're asking the court to adopt, its implications, and occasionally you're in a position where you might be able to sway a justice one way or the other on the outcome. I say this not to discourage you or to convince you that oral argument is not very important, but rather to emphasize to you that you need to keep in mind where the justices are coming from when you're getting up to argue in front of them, because it really does affect the nature of the questions that are asked at oral argument and the types of arguments you need to focus on when you get a chance to make affirmative arguments. The next thing I think I'd like to discuss is actually the type of questions that arise frequently at oral argument in the Supreme Court, because there's a handful of types of questions that arise all the time, and you should be prepared to answer those kinds of questions. And I'm going to do that principally through going through the oral argument in a particular case called Lonchar versus Thomas, I think. This is a case that was before the court when I was clerking. And just so you can understand what's going on in the transcript and in the audio, I'm going to give you a very brief background. This is a death penalty case. Larry Lonchar heinously murdered three people, immediately afterwards was arrested, confessed, then refused to participate in his defense, in fact, refused to attend his trial, asked the court to execute him immediately. He tried to waive the mandatory appeal that state law required. And then after that appeal actually went forward and his conviction and sentence were affirmed, his sister filed a next friend habeas petition trying to contest his competency and try to get the death penalty reconsidered. He opposed that motion in the habeas courts, but there was nonetheless extended hearings over a three-year period at the end of which the court determined that he was competent and that he was competent to waive his right to seek habeas, and that the petition was dismissed. After that, the state set an execution date. His brother then told him that if he didn't file a habeas petition, the brother was going to commit suicide. And this convinced Lonchar to authorize his attorney to file a habeas petition, but he quickly changed his mind and withdrew it. His brother then filed a third attempted habeas petition on his behalf, but that was kicked out after 3 days. Finally, and I think this is in the neighborhood of 8 or 9 years after the conviction, Lonchar agrees to let his attorney file a habeas petition on the reasoning that he wants to delay his execution long enough so that Georgia will change its method of execution from electrocution to lethal injection in the hopes that if he gets lethal injection, he can donate his organs. The district court gets this motion at the within hours of his scheduled execution. The court grants a stay so he can consider the petition. The Court of Appeals vacates the stay, saying, it's too late. You filed this too late. Now, the relevant legal question has to do with this. Rule 9, A and B, of the Federal Rules of Habeas Procedure state that if somebody on a first habeas petition waits too long and the state can show prejudice, then the petition can be dismissed. But in this case, the state didn't rely on Rule 9A because it didn't think it could show that it actually had been prejudiced by the delay. And so the Court of Appeals nonetheless said, well, even beyond Rule 9A, we can deny a stay because a stay of execution is an equitable remedy, and as a matter of equity, we just don't think it's fair for him to wait to the last minute. And so the issue presented to the Supreme Court was to what extent district courts have the lower courts have authority to come up with new reasons to deny stays of execution outside of the scope of the rules. No, that's not good. Hold on. So I'm going to play it from the beginning.
We'll hear argument first this morning, number 95-5015, Larry Lonchar versus Albert Thomas. Mr. Verrilli.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is about the standards that govern federal court's decision whether to entertain a first federal habeas corpus petition. The issue arises in an anomalous factual context. The record is clear that petitioner Larry Lonchar, though found competent, is a deeply disturbed person with suicidal impulses. That mental illness led him to resist efforts by his siblings to challenge his conviction and death sentence in next grand habeas corpus proceedings. He has not been entirely consistent, however.
Well, are you suggesting that one would have to be mentally ill in order to resist efforts to challenge the appeal, to appeal you to your case?
Not in every instance, Mr. Chief Justice, but in this instance, yes. His mental illness is one that produces and has been documented as producing serious suicidal impulses, and that, we think, is the principal reason, and the record shows us the principal reason that led to his resistance of those efforts.
Mr. Verrilli, do we take this case on the assumption, as the 11th Circuit found, that the petitioner is seeking federal habeas for purposes of delaying his execution and not to vindicate any constitutional right he might have?
There is a factual finding to that
effect,
Justice O'Connor.
And so do we take the case on that assumption?
No, Justice O'Connor. In our
view, why not?
In our view, Justice O'Connor, the record shows that the district court found both that Lonchar genuinely seeks to pursue these claims, and that his motive for doing so is solely to achieve delay. In our view, those are irreconcilable. However, it should not matter as a matter of law, even if the court does take the case with that finding unchanged, because our position is that Lonchar's motivation, subjective motivation, for filing a first federal habeas petition should be irrelevant as a matter of law.
I'm going to stop right there. We've heard kind of two sorts of questions that you'll frequently hear in the Supreme Court. The first was by the Chief Justice, which really isn't so much a question as an assertion that your position is ridiculous. The second, by Justice O'Connor, is a genuine question. She has a real interest in knowing what the posture of the case is as it comes to the court. And you will see these kinds of questions come up again and again and again. And the point of these questions is not that Justice O'Connor is genuinely interested in particular about what the 11th Circuit found, but that the factual context of the case will determine the scope of the rule the court will adopt in deciding the case. And so if, in fact, for example, in this case, they take as a given that he had this purpose of wanting to delay the execution but didn't care about vindicating his constitutional rights, well, that's one kind of rule. But if they don't assume that, and they assume that, well, he didn't have an improper purpose, that's a very different kind of case, and it results in a very different kind of rule. you'll notice, I think that the counsel in this case is Don Verrilli, the partner at Jenner and Block, who's a very experienced Supreme Court advocate, does a good job in responding to the Chief Justice's question. You can't just dodge a question because you know it's not genuine. But he doesn't waste a lot of time on it. At the same time, I think he did a particularly good job of answering Justice O'Connor's question in two respects. One is that he immediately gave her a yes or no answer. This is something I'm sure many of you have heard before. When you're asked a question that is susceptible of a yes or no answer, the first words out of your mouth ought to be yes or no, and then you explain, which is what he did here. The other thing I like about this answer is that he gives an answer to the factual question, which he says the 11th Circuit was wrong about the facts. Now, that's a very difficult argument to prevail upon in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is very reluctant to second-guess even the Court of Appeals' factual assumptions about a case. But he nonetheless makes it, but then he moves on to what's likely to be a stronger argument, which is, and even if that is the fact, it's not a relevant fact in our case. And that seems to me to be the proper order to answer them in, because she asked him about the factual question. A lot of people would be inclined to say, well, you know, she says, is that the fact? And your first inclination would be to say, well, that fact doesn't matter because. But that's not responsive to her question. You need to respond to the question first and then explain why that answer doesn't doom your case or isn't otherwise relevant second. I'm going to go on for another couple of minutes or so.
Would not be the subject of inquiry in this case as it is not in civil litigation.
Well, I suppose, though, that you do acknowledge that habeas is an equitable remedy.
We do, Justice O'Connor, yes.
And are we limited to what Rule 9 provides in that regard as to delay in filing, or could conceivably equitable considerations allow a federal court to deny even a first federal habeas?
Now, this is the core question in the case. And Justice O'Connor, when she was on the bench, was actually famous for asking the first question. The Chief Justice beat her to the punch here. But she frequently would ask questions that really go to the core of the case early on. And this is the kind of question you have to expect to get in your argument, and you have to be prepared to give a very succinct, very clear, and very persuasive answer to.
Justice O'Connor, I think there are two separate issues woven together there, and if you permit me, let me try to separate them.
Right.
The first is the passage of time up to the point in June 1995 when Lockhart's federal habeas petition, the petition at issue here, was filed. Our view about that is that Rule 9A governs the analysis of that issue. There's a second issue here about Lockhart's subjective motive for filing as of June 1995. Our position there is that subjective motive should not be a subject of inquiry. If it's a substantial petition, an objectively substantial petition, then it ought to be treated just like a petition for relief in any other kind of case.
Well, Mr. Burley, what if the motive is, you know, to really make a laughing stock out of a federal court?
Your Honor, that's a serious question here. I understand that.
Well, look, take it just as a hypothetical, not necessarily this case. But you're saying motive is immaterial. What if a first habeas petitioner says, I think I've got some good claims here, but I really don't care what the court does. I really just want to make fools of these judges.
I think, Your Honor, if there are substantial claims on the merits, and it's a first petition, that they must be adjudicated. The only reason that motive was injected into the inquiry here was because the district judge put Mr. Lynch on the stand and asked him what his motives were. Our view is that's not a proper subject of inquiry. If there's a
So now we've come across, you know, the dreaded hypothetical. You all, you know, all know about them, you expect them, and you all know that the first rule about hypotheticals is you can't dodge them. And obviously, Mr. Verrilli didn't dodge this one here. Now, you'd be surprised at how tempting it is, even though you know this, that you're not supposed to dodge the hypotheticals, if the first words that would be coming out of your mouth is, well, that's not this case. In part because it sometimes takes you a few seconds to think about what's the real answer to that hypothetical. And once you get past that, though, there's often these hypotheticals are intended as this one is. It's a hostile hypothetical, which is intended to make your position seem unreasonable. And frequently, your first impulse is to deny that the rule that you're proposing would result in this absurd result. This can be a very dangerous impulse. Last term, helped prepare a local lawyer for an argument in the Supreme Court. And he got into a lot of trouble in the moots, and this is why moots are important. Responding to questions like that, where they would say, well, under your rule, doesn't X result? And X sounds completely ridiculous. And he would say, oh, no, X doesn't result. And then, obviously, the next question is, well, why? Why is that? And so then he would try to modify his rule to make sure that X doesn't happen. But then the next question is, well, don't you lose under that modified rule? And the answer to that, of course, is frequently was yes. And so then he had to modify it yet again. The truth is, none of us are smart enough to recraft our argument or our rule on the fly in front of the justices to avoid these ridiculous outcomes. And sometimes what you have to do is simply bite the bullet, as Mr. Verrilli did in this case, and say, yes, that would happen under our rule, and here's why that's not a problem. I'm going to... Oh, this is distressing. I'm going to go forward just a second.
The verification on record, as there was in this case, signed under penalty of perjury pursuant to Habeas Rule 2, that the petitioner genuinely wishes to pursue the claims for relief, that should be the end of the matter.
But if the petition on its face shows that it's frivolous and or malicious, it could be dismissed.
Very definitely, Justice Ginsburg.
Okay, now we've just encountered another kind of question, which is, the life vest being thrown to you. Justice Ginsburg here is suggesting that if his rule is not that problematic, because if in fact the first habeas petition is frivolous on its face, it can be dismissed for that reason. So you don't even have to get to subjective motivation. One of the great skills that people have to develop, and it's surprising how many people don't when it comes time for argument, is to recognize a friendly question, because any number of advocates might see this with distrust. Some people go up in front of the court and view every question with distrust. I think every question is out to catch you and to make you admit something that makes you lose your case. It's very important that you listen carefully and you try to figure out where they're coming from. When you're arguing in front of a group like the Supreme Court, where you know who your audience is and you have a pretty good idea of what their general inclinations are about cases such as yours, you're in a good position. Mr. Verrilli can, for example, have a high degree of confidence that a question like this from Justice Ginsburg is likely to be intended to help him out. A question like this from Justice Scalia is not. You've got to make a judgment. I'm going to move up slightly in the argument.
It's generally under Rule 11 and pursued on the merits.
Well, do you think that there is any ground other than what's stated in 9A and B? Let's assume there's no prejudice to the state and that it can answer the petition, and that it's the first federal habeas. Do you see any room at all for a federal court to dismiss the petition outside of the specifications of 9A and B?
There may be a...
Now, this is a slightly different kind of question. It's a question that is aimed at getting the advocate to precisely articulate what their rule is. The question in this case, one of the principal questions in this case, is whether you can have reasons that are related to delay outside of the scope of Rule 9 for dismissing a petition or denying a stay. You have to know that this kind of question is coming up, and you've got to have, as I said before, a very clear and concise response to the court, because even though the court always understands that the principal reason that they take cases is to set general legal rules that are going to apply to a lot of cases, and that's why they ask all these hypotheticals, not just to show that your rule is stupid, but also to explore the extent of the rule that they might be adopting and how this is going to play out in other cases that are somewhat unlike the case before them, because they want to be very careful that they're not accidentally screwing up the law in the course of deciding this case. I'm going to jump ahead just a second here. Sure. Well, for example, Justice Ginsburg, let me repeat the question, and it's a good one. I had suggested that, and sometimes you've just got to bite the bullet and acknowledge that your rule would result in the extreme sounding result of a hypothetical. And the question was, well, and then I suggested you just got to bite the bullet and then explain why that's not such a problem. And the question is, well, how do you do that? Justice Ginsburg, in this case, helped in that endeavor here by showing there's another rule that will prevent that extreme result from coming up very often. That is, it's frequently the case, she was suggesting, that somebody who has a kind of bad faith subjective motive is going to file an actually objectively frivolous complaint that can be easily dismissed on the merits. Other times you can say, well, look, you know, that's true, it would come up, that's how the rule would play out, but here are some reasons why we don't think that situation would arise very often. Anything you can do to give the court some confidence that bad result is not sufficient to overwhelm the kind of more favorable aspects of your rule. Other questions up to now? Okay, the next piece I'm going to jump ahead to is to show you another very common kind of question, which is not really a question.
Different kind of prejudice was not cognizable in latches as applied to habeas. That was the specific holding of that case.
Mr. Burley, may I go back to the earlier point about the finding that he had taken the action he had solely for the purposes of delay? I don't want to argue your case for you, but
yes, he does.
Another point to be made, you tell me if I'm wrong. Usually when we talk about or when we condemn an application as being made solely for delay, the implication is that it really is not made with a belief in the merits asserted, that it is either in bad faith or it's on the verge of bad faith, and that it's explicable only as a device to postpone an execution. In this case, as I understand it, the finding of delay was made on the understanding that he wanted to preserve his life long enough to see a change in the method of execution so that he could donate his vital organs to, I don't know, the science or to the organ bank or something like that. That isn't delay in sort of the classic sense that has been condemned, is it, no?
So this is another version of a softball, but I think, it's not even a question. It's a suggested argument. And you will see a lot of these in the Supreme Court. And I wanted to give you a little background about why that might be. Again, it goes to the kind of process in the Supreme Court that gets you up to oral argument. And the salient point here is that it is very infrequent that the justices will have talked to each other about the substance of the case in any detail before oral argument. They will meet a few days after oral argument to sit and discuss the case and to vote. But frequently, this is the first time that any of them have gotten much of a view of what anybody else thinks about the case. And so what you often see are justices asking questions that are, in fact, floating ideas to the other justices about the proper disposition of the case or about the proper way to think about a part of the case. This is also, I think, related to the fact that at least under the former Chief Justice, even the discussions at conference were very limited, that the Chief would allow each person to speak once in an order of seniority, speak their mind about the case. There wouldn't be back and forth about it. Everybody would talk and then they'd vote. I understand it's loosened up somewhat under Chief Justice Roberts. But again, I think this kind of puts it helps support this practice of oral argument being in effect, a debate through surrogates at certain points. Do you have a question? Well, that's exactly right. I mean, interesting question is, what do you do in response to a question like this, which is not really a question? Let's see what Mr. Verrilli does.
Well, as a person, if I want to preserve my life, I can then give it away.
You have to let Souter finish his argument first.
If I succeed, and that's what your client wants to do.
Mr. Souter, you put it beautifully. That is exactly.
So, you know, that's one way. And particularly if you're getting a friendly question like that, and it's very helpfully put, you should embrace it, because not only, you know, is Justice Souter a very smart man, but he knows better than you do what the other justices are likely to think is a persuasive argument. Because even though they don't really talk to each other much, frequently they have some idea of where the other justices are because of the interaction of the clerks among the chambers, so that Justice Souter may know through his clerk what Justice O'Connor was tentatively thinking through her clerk, and then have an idea of her particular view about this case. He also, you know, he's decided a lot of cases with Justice O'Connor on the court and has a pretty good idea of what's persuasive to her and what isn't. Later on, I'll talk about what do you do when you're on the wrong side of a question like this, and some other dangers. But here is you know, one way to deal with this kind of question. I wanted to quickly give you an example, mostly because I think it's kind of amusing, of how far this can go. And this is going to be an example from Lawrence versus Texas, the sodomy case. And just to set this up, you know, y'all, I assume, know what Lawrence versus Texas is about. This is a part of the argument where they're talking about the idea of whether a state can say that it can rationally prohibit something because it furthers its interest in preventing immoral behavior. That is prescribing immoral behavior in itself a legitimate rational state interest? Buffering.
And that law goes back how long?
To the 1803. To the time the Texas was proposed.
What about the statute, which this court, I think, once had to grapple with? People felt during World War I that it was immoral to teach German in the public school. So then would you say that the state has every right to do that? Parents want their children to learn German, but the schools forbid it. So the hard question here is, can the state in fact pass anything against the law because they believe it's immoral? If you were going to draw the line somewhere, I guess you might begin to draw it when the person is involved inside his own bedroom and not hurting anybody else. Now, so you say it's morality. I agree. Many people do believe that that's a question of morality. Many do not. But nonetheless, what do you add to what you say other than simply asserting it's morality? Because I don't think you think the state could have anything in the name of morality.
Certainly not. But it would have to be, any law that it would pass would have to have some rational basis to the state interest.
But wouldn't the rat not given us a rational basis except to repeat the word morality?
The basis is that the state thinks it immoral, just as the state thinks adultery immoral or bigamy immoral.
Or teaching German.
Maybe we should go through counsel, yeah.
So there the Chief Justice had to step in and retain the fiction, at least, that they're asking questions of the lawyers. This is, by the way, typical Breyer and typical Scalia. And Breyer will ask these very long, involved questions. Sometimes they actually are genuine questions that he wants an answer to. Frequently, they are summarizing his tentative view of how the central questions in the case should be decided, and then he'll just say, what do you think about that? And then the counsel will stumble around, and then Justice Scalia will answer for him. So we have this aspect of talking to other justices. Sometimes it's very argumentative, but there's another way in which it gets used, which I'm going to go back to the Larry Lonchar case, this death penalty case we're starting with. I'll show you an example of where it's something somewhat different. And again, we're buffering.
Surely I could have done so. It would have been a different matter.
If you didn't invoke Rule 9, if you didn't invoke it, if you didn't say we're going to come in and show that we're prejudiced, so then what you're asking this court to do is to say there's a new ground for denying a habeas petition that no one's ever invoked before. And if there is a good ground, and there may be, I'm not saying there isn't, why isn't that a matter that we would leave to Congress and the Rules Committee, rather than say there's an ill-defined power to make up new grounds, which I guess would work both ways. Sometimes there would be new grounds never made up before to deny petitions, and sometimes there would be new grounds never heard of before for granting petitions. But rather than say there is an ill-defined power in the federal court simply to grant or deny petitions on grounds that have not appeared yet in our cases, not appeared in the rules or in the statutes, rather we'll stick to Barefoot versus Estelle and keep to what we've seen in the past and let Congress and the Rules Committees decide when there are new grounds.
And this is another one of these questions where somebody, it's not really a question, he's advancing a proposition, a principle to resolve the case and saying, tell me why I'm wrong. But this time, as opposed to the prior example, he's asking the person who has to disagree with him. And so this person's in a tough spot because she knows that Justice Breyer is floating this idea. She should assume that he's floating it because he thinks it may be persuasive. Back in this day, and everybody knew that Justice O'Connor would be the swing vote on this case. She has, therefore, this information that this is an argument that at least Justice Breyer thinks will be persuasive to Justice O'Connor. So it's an extremely important point she's got to respond to.
Your Honor, first of all, I think we did plead the way, and we did plead 9A. What we acknowledged at the time of filing the proceedings in the district court was that based upon the contact, that we could not make the particularized.
I'm not saying that you didn't. I'm not turning to blame or praise for a particular instance. I'm saying I take it. Am I there? Tell me if I'm wrong. That you and the 11th Circuit have a new ground for denying a first petition never invoked before. Certainly my law clerks and me at library could not find a comparable instance forever. Maybe this kind of thing is good. Maybe it isn't. But the issue before us, I would take it, is whether there is a general power in the federal courts to create new grounds not found in Barefoot versus Estelle or later cases for either granting or denying petitions. If that's the issue, I guess my first thought would be, why isn't it up to Congress of later experience or the Rules Committees to embody those new kinds of grounds, rather than simply giving a mandate to the lower courts to do whatever they think is nice in the
circumstances. So you notice she made a bit of a mistake in her first attempt to answer the question, in that she didn't respond to it at the level of generality that it was intended, and didn't recognize that he was asking her a very general question about this basic principle of to what extent do we allow lower courts to make up rules outside the context of the written rules and the rules of habeas procedure. And he's clearly suggesting that that's a very problematic thing to do. It's hard to cabin, and shouldn't we leave this to the legislature? And instead, she gives an answer about the pleadings in this case. So Justice Breyer very nicely spends another 3 minutes repeating this question so she can try again.
Your Honor, I submit to you that this is not in the grant. We're not asking the court.
We could find no instance, so you can tell me what the instance is. We could find no instance in the first petition where a court has denied the first petition without following Rule 9 or some other well-established ground. Now, what is the instance?
I'll agree with you on that, Your Honor. I can find no factual scenario out there like this anywhere.
This seems to be the opposite of what she just said before. But I think in reality what happened was that she made a mistake in articulating a thought that she had, which was, I think her point was going to be that we are simply asking, and she'll make this point eventually, that we are simply asking courts to apply the general vague equitable discretion that they've always had, and that that's not a new rule. But she phrased it in a way that invited a misunderstanding that provoked the justice to interrupt her and not let her get her thought out. And that's an important lesson to you, that you need to be extremely careful how you say things and not to say things in a way that is susceptible of misinterpretation, particularly when you're saying things about the record or about what a case says, because you are very likely to be challenged on it and it'll eat up time and you'll end up back, like what she had to do is concede, okay, yes, I agree with what your interpretation of this is, and now let me get back to my answer. And eventually, she does get to a real answer.
So then am I right in thinking what this court would be doing if you're upheld is to say the lower federal courts are free to create new grounds. Sometimes they'll be for denying petitions. Sometimes they'll be for granting petitions. We'll have to supervise it, I guess. And that seems a rather far-reaching proposition and contrary to Barefoot versus Estelle. And that's what I'm putting you to hear in your response.
Your Honor, what we would submit is what the district courts have the discretion to do is to examine new issues as they arise, new factual and procedural scenarios as they come up under long-established ethical principles. We're asking that this court allow the district court to utilize what this court has consistently recognized the district court to do, and that is look at ethics.
So she finally gets around to a reasonable response, and it does tee up the basic question in this case, which you see in a lot of cases, is the desirability of flexible rules versus clear standards, or the other way around. Clear rules versus flexible standards. I want to jump ahead because you can quite clearly see in this oral argument that Justice Breyer's tactic is working, or at least it appears to be, because Justice O'Connor eventually gets around to asking some questions that give us some clues to her thinking about this case.
We would submit to the court that there should be a way for the district court to take that into consideration. However,
Ms. Westmoreland, do you take the position that a last-minute filing of a first federal habeas without all these intervening experiences is inherently prejudicial under Rule 9A? Do you take the position that it fits under 9A simply because the filing is so close to the deadline?
Now, this question is a tricky one for the counsel because in one way you can interpret it as saying, as Justice O'Connor is suggesting, that your view is kind of trying to twist what Rule 9A is, where Rule 9A requires the state to show prejudice, and she's saying, well, are you saying that any time it's late, you know, prejudice is shown by the lateness, in which case the prejudice requirement wouldn't make much sense. And that's how the counsel interprets it, and so this is her response.
No, Your Honor, we've not taken that position in our brief, primarily because we don't need to take that position. We don't need for the court to take that step in this case because that's simply not
what happened. But that's not as big a step as saying the court can go outside Rule 9 and develop new grounds.
So it turns out that what Justice O'Connor was really trying to do is offer counsel a narrower ground for winning the case, that is, a ground under which you would win because the court would say you win under Rule 9, but we're not going to let courts make up rules outside of the federal rules of habeas procedure. And in fact, counsel turned around and again after this question repeats that that's not their position. They're not trying to say that they win under the current rules. And it turns out that that's a fatal mistake in this case. The Supreme Court ends up deciding this case essentially 5-4 in favor of Lonchar and holding that the courts don't have jurisdiction or don't have the authority to deny stays of executions for reasons related to delay outside of those permitted in the rule, and leaving undecided whether this kind of delay could result in a denial within the meaning of Rule 9. And that's not just to cast aspersions on this lawyer. It's just to show that the critical importance of being able to figure out, why the justices are asking you a question. It is frequently the case that the justices will be searching around to find a modification of the rule that you're proposing, frequently that you will still win under, but that gives them less heartburn than the rule that you're proposing. And you need to be flexible enough to accept that invitation when you see that you need to. And in a case like this, when it's Justice O'Connor making the suggestion, you have a pretty good indication that it's ground you have to give in order to win the case. Sometimes it's not nearly as clear, and then you just got to do the best that you can. Any questions thus far? Finally, I want to jump to the very end of this to show you one final kind of question that's exemplified in this case that you frequently get. And this is rebuttal.
Mr. Brill, you have 3 minutes remaining.
If the court has no further questions, we'll look at it. I have just one question. I should know this on the basis of what method of execution is Georgia now using? What tradition is still used for?
Sometimes you end up with just questions that justices are just curious about something. Now here, Larry Lonchar's whole point was that he wanted to delay his execution so that they would not be using electrocution anymore. And so Justice Stevens was curious, have they changed it yet? There was a case once in which, I think it was Justice Stevens again, he frequently asked these kinds of questions. It was a case, some regulatory case involving a beer manufacturer. And his question was, what's the difference between beer and ale? So you need to know your case well enough to field questions out of left field like that. So let me give you a postscript about this case before we move on to talk about some others. At the end of this, as I said before, the Supreme Court says Larry Lonchar was entitled to a stay. It goes back to the lower courts, at which point Larry Lonchar says, once again, he wants to die. He acquiesces, they execute him. A few weeks later, Congress passes the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which creates new rules for stays and first habeas petitions, vitiating this decision. So the whole exercise turned out to be a complete waste of time. But, that happens. There's one other type of very common question, which didn't really, there's not a good example of in this case, but I wanted to mention it to you. And it actually came up recently. You may have read about the big punitive damages case against Philip Morris that the Supreme Court heard argument in on Monday. Folks are expecting that the court would use this to kind of give greater clarity to the constitutional limitations on juries' ability to impose large punitive damages awards. But nearly the first question, the first sentences out of Philip Morris's lawyer's mouth got interrupted by a barrage of questions from the court about the jury instructions in this case. And Philip Morris was basically saying that the instructions given to the jury here unconstitutionally allowed it to punish Philip Morris for injuries that it inflicted on other people. But the court turned around and said, well, we've taken a look at the instruction that you proposed instead, and it's really confusing, and the court might have been justified in denying your requested instruction and giving the one it did, simply because yours was so bad. And it turned out that was a huge issue in the case, and it looks very much like the Supreme Court may never reach the merits of the question. It is frequently the case that the court asks questions about the procedural posture of the case, about whether questions have been preserved below, about whether issues have been waived at oral argument, in part because sometimes these are issues that the parties themselves fail to adequately brief. They're so focused on the merits questions. Yes, sir. Well, you have to make a distinction between kind of developing narrower rules and kind of implementing idiosyncratic irrational exceptions to sensible rules. I would be very surprised if the court said we have a special constitutional rule for tobacco cases, or that we have a special constitutional or special habeas rule for people who want to donate their organs. It's more often the case, though, that the court will say, you know, we'll say we'll have a special rule for cases, as was suggested in Lonchar, for people who don't actually want the relief that they're seeking or simply seeking delay. That might have been a narrower ground that they would have accepted. And the punitive damages case, you know, I could see them thinking that there might need to be special rules for mass torts where the defendants are potentially subject to multiple kind of overlapping punitive damages awards. As I was saying before, the reason the court frequently gets it is the parties don't address it. Sometimes these questions become jurisdictional questions and the court feels that it has to raise it itself. Sometimes the procedural posture of the case will permit the court to more narrowly decide the case than the parties are asking it to. And this is a court that prefers narrower answers to broader answers. And sometimes, and perhaps this is the case in Philip Morris, it provides the court a way out of a case that it's now decided it doesn't really want to decide, which sometimes happens when the court grants a case but then realizes it's going to have a hard time reaching a majority opinion to resolve it. So I'm going to move on now to talk about, okay, we've been focusing on the kinds of things that the court asks. I want to focus now on what the advocates do. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, before you move on, getting back to Justice O'Connor's question, Ms. Westmoreland.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what in your opinion, is that Ms. Westmoreland, I mean, I'm sure she's prepared to speak, what do you think will contribute to a failure to recognize that kind of helpful question?
Well, that one was a particularly tricky one. I mean, just to be fair, I think they made that strategic decision about whether or not to try to bring their objection under the Rule 9A at trial. She would have a very hard time actually accepting that position now. I mean, Justice O'Connor may have cut her some slack, but I think a lot of the other justices might have thought that, in fact, it's too late to switch horses. Yes, she could have done that, and I think part of it is not recognizing perhaps the degree of the court's concern and Justice O'Connor's concern about kind of the unfettered discretion of courts to make up reasons to deny habeas petitions. I think, you know, that she fundamentally misjudged what Justice O'Connor's major concerns were in this case. So at oral argument, you know, obviously what you're trying to do ultimately is persuade the court to rule in your favor. Your ability to do that, as I said before, is limited by the fact that they've thought about this case already quite a lot, and by the time that you have, particularly when you have a very active bench. What you can't do, for example, is simply give an oral presentation of the brief that you've written. The justices won't let you because it's a waste of their time. They've already read the brief. Instead, the best you can do and what you need to try to do is focus on the broad general themes of the case, the major concerns that the court may have about your position. And again, a lot of this is going to focus on the exact nature of the rule that you're asking them to adopt, what it means in other cases, and trying to give the court some comfort that the troubling aspects of your position can be dealt with are not as bad as they may seem, or at least aren't as bad as the consequences for ruling on the other side's, in the other side's favor.
Um,
So let me just kind of walk through. I'm going to give some more examples. Obviously, the first thing you do when you get up in front of the court is you generally have at least a minute, 30 seconds to say something uninterrupted. You have an opportunity to make an opening statement. Sometimes you'll get up there and they'll start asking you questions right away, but you usually can plan to have enough time to say a few sentences, and those sentences are critical because they're the only ones you can be assured that you're going to get out. And even then, you're not assured. And I'm going to start off by giving you an example of what not to do.
We'll hear argument now, number 95386, Jason Richards versus Jefferson County. Mr. Baxley.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This is a right judicata due process question that we hear on today. Leading in, I'd like to give a short quote out of the case of Chase National Bank versus Norwalk. Justice Brandeis says, unless duly summoned to appear in a legal proceeding, a person not a prisoner may rest assured that a judgment recovered therein will not affect his legal rights. That quote was also cited by Chief Justice in the Martin v. Willis case, and quoted along with some other quotes from Justice Brandeis in that case. The second little lenient quote I'd like to give, because it was cited, the case was cited by the respondent, the Fifth Circuit case, Southwest Airlines versus Texas International. And they quoted Judge Wilson as saying, quote, denial of the opportunity to bring a suit raises serious due process questions.
There are a number of things wrong with this. First, you know, undoubtedly those quotes are in his brief, and undoubtedly the Supreme Court is aware of them. You don't need to read to the court things that it's already aware of. The explicit sucking up to the Chief Justice by saying that, you know, you quoted Justice Brandeis and Wilkes, you know, rarely gets you anywhere, and frequently, and then you'll see later in this case, can backfire and annoy the justices. And finally, you know, the Fifth Circuit, the Supreme Court doesn't care what the Fifth Circuit thinks about this question, and they particularly don't care that Judge Wisdom said this, you know, uncontroversial thing that, you know, there's a constitutional issue when you preclude somebody from being in a case. Of course, there is. The question is it in fact unconstitutional in this case? What you want to do instead in your opening statement is condense into two or three sentences the major themes of your brief and hopefully of your argument, explaining why it is that you ought to win in a way that is going to be convincing to the court on the kind of major concerns that they're going to have and are going to be exploring at oral argument. Now, I'm going to give you a couple examples of good opening statements. This first one is from Seth Waxman.
This Supreme Court audio is brought to you by a gift from the law firm of Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Law to the OEA.
Very nice. Let me back up.
It's about that.
I may not be able to avoid this. Hey, hold on.
This Supreme Court audio.
Just say, this is... This is Seth Waxman, the former Solicitor General. He's a partner now at Wilmer Cutler. Actually, I don't think it's called that anymore. Very experienced Supreme Court oral advocate. This is Roper, the case about juvenile executions.
O-R-G.
Well, your argument now in number 03-633, Donald Roper versus Christopher Simmons. Mr. Layton.
Mr. Chief.
Oh. Sorry, this is the other side. This is, what's his name? James Layton, who is the Solicitor General of Missouri.
Justice, and may it please the court. Though bound by Stanford v. Kentucky, the Missouri Supreme Court rejected both its holding and its rationale. This court should stay the course it set in Stanford, leaving in the hands of legislators a determination as to the precise minimum age for capital punishment within the realm of Thompson v. Oklahoma, and leaving to jurors responsibility for determining the culpability of individual defendants above that minimum age. The Missouri court justified its departure from Stanford on Atkins v. Virginia, but the result it reached is quite different from the result in Stanford. In Atkins. In that case, the court was addressing mental ability, itself a component of culpability. The court announced a principle based on that characteristic, that is, that the mentally retarded are not to be eligible for capital punishment. But then it left to the states the determination of the standard and the means of implementing that principle. The Missouri Supreme Court, by contrast, jumped beyond the question of maturity, which is an element of culpability analysis, to the arbitrary distinction of age.
Now, there are several things I like about this opening. One is that one of the themes you can tell is going to be one of the themes of the presentation is going to be that the Missouri Supreme Court disregarded the Supreme Court's on-point binding precedent, because the Supreme Court had said in years past that it was not unconstitutional to execute somebody under 18. And so one of Missouri's main points is you've already decided this, there's no reason to reconsider it. He also makes clear that they're not simply advocating that you should permit execution of juveniles because that's a good thing. Instead, it makes a federalism argument that this is a question that ought to be left to the states, which is a kind of argument that is likely to appeal to Justice Kennedy, who's going to turn out to be, and everybody knew this from the beginning, the swing justice in this case, because he had voted with the majority in Atkins, the case that said it's unconstitutional to execute the mentally ill. But Justice Kennedy is also a very staunch supporter of federalism principles and state rights. He also makes the point that under the rule Missouri is proposing, it doesn't mean that people under 18 will necessarily be executed. It simply means that you'll have, again, this is a rules versus standards thing. We're not going to have a bright line rule. We're going to have a flexible standard under which juries determine how mature and responsible for their actions a particular defendant is. And that, one of the things that does is gives the justices some reason to believe that there's not going to be a lot of juvenile executions, even if you rule in the state's favor in this case, which is something that they think is going to be worrying to Justice Kennedy. Let me skip ahead to Seth Waxman's opening. He's on the other side representing the juvenile in this case. I should say that the one other point is that you notice he immediately in the beginning of his statement gets to Atkins and explains why Atkins is distinguishable from this case, because he knows that that's one of the central weaknesses on his side. And if he can't explain why this case is different than Atkins, he's going to lose. And so you might as well do it up front and make your point.
Very well, Mr. Lee. Mr. Waxman, we'll hear from you.
That sound, by the way, is the podium at the Supreme Court has a crank on it that allows you to raise and lower it. Seth Waxman is a fairly tall man, but a lot of experienced Supreme Court practitioners do it just to show that they know it's there and what it's for.
Everyone agrees that there is some age below which juveniles can't be subject to the death penalty. The question here is where our society's evolving standards of decency now draw that line. 15 years ago, this court found insufficient evidence to justify a bright line at 18. But since Stanford, a consensus has evolved and new scientific evidence has emerged, and these developments changed the constitutional calculus for much the same reasons the court found compelling in Atkins.
So again, you see that he does something very similar. He starts off by recognizing one of the principal weaknesses in his case, which is that the Supreme Court had previously said you can execute people under 19. And his response is to say that the court there didn't say that was the concrete rule for all time, but simply that there was insufficient evidence at that time, and that since that time we've gotten new information, ideals have evolved such that there is in fact a substantial reason for revisiting the issue in this case. And then recognizing the same thing that his counterpart did, he moves on to Atkins to show that the court has, in the very recent past, done a similar thing, reconsidered a prior ruling about who could be subject to execution in light of evolving standards of decency. So you have your opening statement. The length of these statements is about as much as anybody gets out. Unless, I should say, sometimes you'll go there and you'll see them let somebody talk on and on when it's clear from the very beginning that talking to this person is going to be a waste of time. There are two occasions. What? Yeah, well, they actually end up questioning him quite a lot, and we'll get to some of that. And they'd ask him the same question about 14 different times because he doesn't understand it. And then they eventually give up and just let him talk. The other time you sometimes don't get a lot of questions is if, in fact, the court actually agrees with you. They tend to be more aggressive in questioning the side that they don't agree with. But in the Supreme Court, you know, they've taken the question because the courts of appeals have disagreed about the outcome, and that's usually a pretty good indication that people on the court are going to disagree about that, at least think it's arguable, and so you have a very active bench. I should say it's not always the same in the lower courts. I actually met Tom in a case where we argued en banc in the Fifth Circuit on the same side. I was arguing for the government, and he was arguing for the plaintiff. There were 15 members of that bench, and I probably got three questions over about 20 minutes, and I think that's not uncommon. You need to be prepared for the forum that you're in. In a case like that, you need to be prepared to make a speech. In the Supreme Court, you generally don't need to be prepared to talk straight for half an hour. So after you get past that first few sentences, the rest of the time is going to be spent answering questions and trying to work in the points that you want to work in, with the emphasis on answering the questions. Some inexperienced folks will think that it's an okay answer to the question and say, well, I'm going to get to that in a few minutes if you'll let me. It is not, you're not there to give a presentation to the court. You're there to be helpful to the court. And it's not only just a simple matter that they're the boss and you're not. It's also that you are, this is your only opportunity to get feedback from the court about what they're thinking about your case. And so it's much more important for you to listen carefully to the questions that you're getting and to try to respond to them, because some of the justices are going to toy around with you. Like the Chief Justice's first question at the beginning of this, where he's just sort of mocking you, and Scalia will do that some too, but a number of the justices are very straight shooters, and the questions they ask are questions that are really troubling to them about your position, and so you can have a great deal of confidence that it's extremely important to answer them. Okay, so let's talk about how to answer questions. First, at the very simplest thing, which you ought to already know, but sometimes people forget, is that you don't start your answer until they're done with their question. And if they start a question while you're talking, you stop talking and you listen. It's remarkable, both in the Supreme Court, but even more so in the lower courts, how many lawyers think that they're entitled to talk over a judge. And it's just not acceptable. It makes you look like a jerk. It pisses off the judges. It's just, there's no upside to it. The second rule is you have to actually answer the question that they've asked. And that sounds obvious, but it's actually harder than you think. Because frequently you'll be going along and you'll be making a point, and you'll have a train of thought, and a justice will start asking a question that's related to what you're talking about. So your natural inclination is to think that the justice is thinking somewhere along the same lines as you are. But if you're not careful, you can miss the fact that they are, in fact, asking you a different question than you would expect them to ask you at this point in your presentation. And so let me give you an example, and we're going back to our friend in the race judicata case, if I can pull that up.
To authorize taxpayer suits, not in the sense of people who are being subject to a tax, but in the sense of challenging expenditure of public money.
Let me just give you some context for this. This is a case in which the state imposes an occupational tax. There's an initial lawsuit by some taxpayers who challenge it under state law grounds. They lose. A second taxpayer who's subject to the tax files a federal lawsuit raising a federal constitutional claim about it. And the state court says, no, you are bound by the res judicata effect of the first suit that you want a party to. And so the question is that res judicata rule a violation of due process? And one of the major issues in the cases is that there are all kinds of cases out there about taxpayer standing. And by taxpayer standing, I mean suits under state law that are permitted just because you're a taxpayer to challenge an expenditure of state money or a federal or a state tax in violation of state law. Those kinds of suits you couldn't bring in federal court because there's not a general taxpayer standing doctrine in federal court as a general matter. You have to meet Article III injury in fact standing requirements. And so you have this situation where there are cases that can be brought in state court but not federal court, and some states have said we're only going to allow one of those types of state lawsuits. The first one is conclusive of all other taxpayers. And so what just the Chief Justice is getting at here is, isn't that kind of case not problematic, because all you're losing is a chance that you never actually had to bring a claim in federal court in the first place, even though the case before the court was not that kind of case, because it was, in fact, somebody challenging a tax imposed on themselves. So the Chief Justice is trying to get this counsel to understand that distinction.
Any person in the state who pays taxes may challenge the, and I think many states have this. Do you think a state has to allow more than one of those suits?
No, but I don't think they have.
Or were there really getting any personal property interest at stake?
I think my answer there would be that you pretty well hit on the head in Martin B. Wilkes, and in your opinion, where you said it's really the burden.
Sucking up again.
Is on the parties, or on the parties that are litigating it, to determine what the issues are going to be. When this issue was litigated in Bedingfield, if the county had really wanted to come in and have the due process and the due process rights provided and the equal protection matter settled once and for all, they could have brought it up.
I don't believe that's responsive to my question. Listen, please.
That's something you don't want to hear. Listen, please. You should listen without being asked. But this was a case where this counsel had an idea. I don't know if he had an idea of what the Chief Justice was really asking him about, or if he just had a point that he wanted to make. But he wasn't being responsive to the Chief Justice's question, and that's not a good thing. I want to give you another example of not answering the question and the kind of trouble that can get you in. And this is going back to Lawrence again. This is another typical Justice Breyer question that we're going to hear.
Something that ought to be taught in the schools is religion. The argument of Bowers to overrule Bowers is not directly related to Stalin. It's related, but not direct. That people in their own bedrooms, which have their right to do basically what they want, it's not hurting other people. And the other side says Bowers understated the importance of that. It got the history wrong. It didn't understand the relationship of the sodomy and family. And in addition, Bowers has proved to be harmful to thousands and thousands and thousands of people, if not because they're going to be prosecuted, because they fear it might, they might be, which makes it a possible instrument of repression in the hands of the prosecutors. Now, that's the kind of argument that they're making. Harmful in consequence, wrong in theory, understating the constitutional value. Now, how do you respond to that?
Okay, first of all, let me correct something as
very light at this point, but the allegation was made in petitioner's argument that people convicted of homosexual conduct were banned from jobs and housing and all that kind of thing. In Texas, homosexual conduct is a Class C misdemeanor. That is, it is the lowest misdemeanor, or the lowest...
So again, this is another example of somebody who's being asked a very big question. You know, it goes to the heart of at least one justice's concern about the central issue in the case, and instead of directly answering that, he kind of uses this as an occasion to correct some minor inaccuracy that the other side had stated in their brief. It's not a good idea because, you know, number one, it's, you know, Justice Breyer has given you a chance to address his main concern about your position and then told you what it is. And number two, you're not going to get away with it, as you can see next.
Prohibition that Texas...
That I didn't bring in my question.
Yes, sir.
My question was...
Right. So you can imagine what's going to happen here. He's going to tell the whole two-minute hypothetical again. So, you know, you see the point. You need to figure out, you know, what is the court actually asking about it and be responsive to it. Let me give you an example of somebody answering a question well, and this is going to come from the Michigan affirmative action cases. This is Maureen Mahoney, who's a partner at, I believe, Latham & Watkins, who's another very experienced Supreme Court advocate.
For students of all color.
Ms. Mahoney, supposing that after our Bakke decision came down, Cal Davis had set aside 16 seats for disadvantaged minorities, and Cal Davis says, all right, we're going to try to get those 16 seats in some other way. We're going to try high school graduates, we're going to try socioeconomic, and none of those methods get the 16 seats that they want. Can they then go back and say, we've tried everything, now we're entitled to set aside 16 seats?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what the court's judgment in Bakke said, and certainly what Justice Powell's opinion said, is that it's simply not necessary to do a set aside because a plan like the Harvard plan, which takes race into account as one factor, can be used as an effective means
to... But my hypothesis was they wanted 16 seats, and that plan just won't give it to them.
Well, if the program was designed to have a fixed 16 seats, no matter what the qualifications of the applicant pool, no matter what the disparities between the minority and majority students would be, then I think it's fair to say that that would be a quota, if that was the nature of the program. But here, the record indicates that the law school's program is nothing of the kind, that what has occurred over the years with this program is that there have been offers that have ranged from 160 to 232 over the course of 8 years. There have been enrollments that went from 44 to 73. It has been a very flexible program.
So there are several things that I like about this exchange. First, notice that even a very experienced Supreme Court counsel, she partially bucks the hypothetical at first, and it may be because she didn't quite understand the critical aspect that the Chief Justice was trying to get at, which was the inflexibility of the minimum number that they were trying to get at. But once she was reminded of that and kind of could focus on what was the actual question, she gives a good answer. She gives a good answer first, in that she gives him a direct answer, yes or no, right away, as we mentioned before. She's willing to say that hypothetical the school loses under, even though she's representing the school. There's frequently your temptation, your gut reaction is going to be, I can never say that my side loses under any hypothetical. But frequently, you know, you not only can, but you should say that they do, particularly when you've got very strong grounds for saying that your case is distinguishable in an important way. But again, the important thing is to answer the question first and then, as she does, explain why your case is different. And the final thing that I like about her answer is that in explaining why her case is different, she is very specific. She cites actual numbers from the record, rather than simply saying, well, you know, our numbers have varied a lot. She's very concrete and particular about it, which shows that she has mastered the record in this case, and that the court doesn't simply have to take her word for it when she characterizes their program as flexible. I want to give you another example of a good answer to a hostile hypothetical, and this is again coming out of Lawrence. This is Paul Smith, who's a partner at General Block, another repeat player at the Supreme Court.
The relationship between the individual and the state, but depends on what you mean by our basic American values. To revert to what the Chief Justice was suggesting earlier, really what's at issue in this case is whether we're going to adhere to, in the first part of the case, not the equal protection aspect, it's whether we're going to adhere to what we said in Luxembourg. Namely, that before we find a substantive due process right, a fundamental liberty, we have to assure ourselves that that liberty was objectively deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. That's what we said in Glucksberg, and we said it in other cases. Or we're going to depart from that and go to the approach that we've adopted with regard to the Eighth Amendment, which is that it evolves and changes in social values will justify a new perception of what is called unusual punishment. Now, why should we slip into the second mode? I mean, suppose all the states have laws against flagpole sitting at one time. Time was a popular thing and probably annoyed a lot of communities. And then almost all of them repeal those laws. Does that make flagpole sitting a fundamental right?
No, Your Honor, but the court's decisions don't look just at history. They look at the function that a particular claimed freedom plays in the lives of real people. That's why contraception became an issue. That's why abortion...
I don't know what you mean, the function it plays in the lives of real people.
The court has said...
Any law stops people from doing what they really want to do.
The court has said that it is going to use reasoned judgment to identify a realm of personal liberty that involves matters that are central and core to how a person finds their own lives and relates to key other people. It's about moral upbringing of children in the home. It's about procreation or non-procreation in your sexual relations with your mate. It's about basic questions of what kind of family you're going to live with and others in the association.
This is another hypothetical designed to make your position look ridiculous. But even then, he follows the proper form. He answers the question, no. And then he explains why. But he explains why in a way that goes to the heart of the point that Justice Scalia was trying to make, which was that under his view, you establish a fundamental right solely by reference to history and the answer was, well, that's not the way that the court has actually performed that analysis. What I think is particularly good about the answer in this case is he knows he's never, there's no way in hell he's going to get Justice Scalia's vote in this case. So he uses this question as an opportunity to give an answer to Justice Kennedy. This is the kind of rhetoric, this is the kind of ideas that are going to be appealing to Justice Kennedy. It's a very good use of your time if you can, even though you know you're just fending off somebody who's being hostile to you, if you can answer questions in a way that are not responsive to the core concerns of that person, because they're not going to vote for you anyway, but to the people who might vote for you. I'm going to kind of move more quickly now and I think stop with the examples. Let me just give you some general thoughts about answering questions, and then we're going to move on to making your affirmative points. As you may have been able to see from what we've listened to, there isn't time in an oral argument to have a big wind-up to your answer. You can't say, 3 or 4 sentences before you actually give the answer, in the way that you can in a brief. You've got to get to the point, because, you know, if you don't, you're just going to get interrupted. As I mentioned before, you know, in giving your answers, you need to be careful how you say things, because they can also, if you exaggerate something or you don't say something quite right, it can prompt an interruption, which you don't want. That this is particularly likely to happen if you hyperbolize. If you say, you know, no court has ever held X, and there's 3 courts that have held X. They're completely irrelevant courts, and it doesn't reduce the strength of your argument to say almost no court has ever held or few courts have held. But just that bit of hyperbole, because this one of the justices is going to know that actually, in fact, there's some, you know, district court in the Southern District of Missouri who's decided this question, you know. They're going to bring that up and make, you know, just because you're wrong. So let's move on to making the affirmative point. These are things that you make when you have a chance. These are points that you want to make as part of your answers to questions when the opportunity arises. Again, you need to be selective in the kinds of points you make. You cannot retry, go into an oral argument and try to say everything that you said in your brief. And again, you need to focus on the kinds of questions that are going to be, number one, important to the court and making its decision at this late stage. Again, this goes to focusing on the scope of the rule that you're asking the court to adopt, being clear, making clear what your position is and what it's not. Frequently, the other side is going to try to mischaracterize your position and what it entails and what it will result in order to get the court to think that it's an undesirable rule. And you need frequently an oral argument to set the record straight, particularly if you are the respondent, the person who goes first, who didn't have, so that the last word before the court was the reply brief. And this is your first and only opportunity to correct things that were said in the reply brief. So that's frequently something that you're focused on trying to do in your presentation. It's also important to keep in mind that there are some kinds of arguments that are simply not very amenable to oral presentation. In your brief, for example, you can easily go through a fairly complex regulatory scheme and show how subpart A of section 2, you know, incorporates the definition from subpart 3 and blah, 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 you know, and go through all of that. It's very hard to say that during an oral presentation, and frequently, even though that may be the core issue in the case, you have to assume that the court has read and digested that part of your brief and talk about something else. And the source of something else is that frequently get talked about at oral argument are these consequentialist issues, these concerns about the practical impact of your position, of your opponent's position, in part because that's easy to talk about, but also because, at least in this court, in this Supreme Court, they are very concerned about those issues. These are, by and large, very pragmatic justices who understand that in deciding your case, they're going to affect a lot of other people as well. There's one other piece of this, and this is something that you just have to practice. Is one of the big tricks is transitioning from answering questions to making your point and trying to, in some degree, control the argument. It's very easy to get up there, get caught up in answering questions, lose your train of thought, forget what you want to say, and then at the end of a question, pause, and you'll pause just long enough for somebody to ask you another question. And at the end of it, you'll have answered a lot of questions but never made the points that you got up there wanting to make. And there's a couple ways that you can deal with this. One, a very effective way, is to, particularly when you're being badgered by somebody who's not actually trying to be very helpful to your case, is to quickly answer their question and without pausing at all, move on to your next point. You frequently see people do this. They'll answer the question and say, now if I can turn to, you know, this issue. And in doing that, you know, it does two things. You know, it gets you talking about that issue. And you obviously don't actually want to wait and see if they'll say, yes, you can. You just go ahead and you start talking about it. But sort of by quasi-asking permission, you can frequently buy yourself a couple sentences that the justices will recognize that you have a legitimate interest in addressing that question. And so they'll let you go ahead and do it for a little while. What you're unlikely to be able to do, and what you see people do sometimes, is say, okay, I would like to make the following 3 points, and say what those points are, and then start number 1. You're never going to get to number 2 and number 3. And you might not even get to number 1. while it's a fine thing to do when you're giving an oral presentation like this or something, you just, it's not going to work in an oral argument setting unless you can do it really, literally, in one sentence. Say, I'm going to say these three things and then, you know, start, and then hopefully you'll get to the other ones later. Now, just a few miscellaneous things I wrote down at the end of my notes. Obviously, you need to assume that the court's familiar with your materials. Don't waste time talking to them about the facts of the case or the procedural posture of the case, except to the extent that it's relevant to the questions before the court. You need to be specific. And actually, I do want to give you one good example of this, a bad example of not being specific. I gave you the good example of Maureen Mahoney citing the numbers of admission slots in the Michigan case. We're going to go back to our friend in the race judicata case, who's kind of my whipping boy tonight. Justice was really exasperated with this guy by the end of this argument, but saying, you know, if the court says, you know, what's your case for this, or what's your proposition, your support for this proposition, you don't just say this court has held that. You know, you need to have specific cases in mind. You need to have a specific answer for the court. Let me move on to talk about what's special about being a respondent. Let me first, before we get to that, I've been kind of talking about the answer to the question as if you're the petitioner, you're up there first. So let's finish in that mode. The last thing you need to think about is reserving a little bit of time for rebuttal. Most people think you should only reserve a couple minutes because there are various thoughts about this. One, Chief Justice Roberts actually wrote an article about oral advocacy back when he was a lawyer. And one of the things he noted is that spending more time than that on rebuttal raises the possibility that the court is going to think of something new to ask you about. And it's almost never to your advantage to be in that position where the court has thought of some new problem with your case that it had forgotten to ask you about before and wants to ask you about now, but in a context where you don't have enough time to actually give an answer. So that's one reason not to reserve a whole lot of time. And another, as a practical matter, in a lot of courts of appeals, even if you only have a couple minutes and you get up there, you can frequently squeeze out several minutes more. It's not true in the Supreme Court. There's a famous instance in which somebody ran out of time, and they're the petitioner. They spent their entire 30 minutes without reserving any for oral argument, and at the end of it, the guy says to the Chief Justice, which was Rehnquist back then, I had meant to reserve some time for rebuttal, and the Chief Justice said, well, you haven't. And he didn't get any rebuttal time. So you need to be careful about the time that you have to make sure that you actually save time for rebuttal. So when you're the respondent, much of what I've already said also applies. You have to answer the questions. You have to focus on what the court's asking about. You have to have a theme in mind that you want to come back to again and again. You do ordinarily have an opportunity to give an opening statement of a few sentences. The difference is that by the time you get up there as a respondent, you will have been listening to the court for half an hour, and you will be in a much better position to know what they're concerned about and what the weaknesses of your opponent's case is and in your case are than you were when you walked in the room. And so you need to be much more flexible than the petitioner can be going in. And some people even go so far as to write several different opening statements of your respondent and pick which one you're going to give based on what's gone on in the prior half hour. Give the opening statement that's responsive to the major issue that the court has identified in the previous discussion. I frequently, when I'm a respondent, will have done the same sort of preparation I've written out, and we'll talk about preparation in a second, the major kinds of things I want to make sure that I get to. But as I'm listening to the argument, I'll highlight, you know, which ones I really, really want to get to now in light of what I've heard and make sure that those are the ones I focus on. The one other point I would say about rebuttal, actually, is and then the Roberts article mentions this, is the one other benefit is that just knowing that you're going to get up again might keep your opponent honest. It'll keep them from saying something outrageously untrue, knowing that you're not going to get up, be able to get up and contradict them, which, you know, there's something to that. So let's talk for a few minutes about preparation then. And this will go from the kind of big picture to the mundane. Obviously, at the big picture level, what you want to do is try to anticipate as much as possible what are going to be the major issues at oral argument. And that generally entails figuring out the weaknesses of your case and the weaknesses of your opponent's case and figuring out ways to take advantage of the other side's weaknesses and provide concise, persuasive answers to the weaknesses in your own. And so as a practical matter, what I do and what a lot of people do when they're sitting down to start preparing is you reread everything again. You reread the briefs and you take extensive notes about, you know, what are the best points. What are the points when you're reading the other side's brief that makes you say, ooh, you know, they've got a point there. Or even if you don't think they've got a point, you say, oh, you know, Justice Kennedy is going to think that they've got a point there and I've got to address that. You will frequently then also want to do some additional research, particularly if you are, again, the respondent and something has come up in the reply brief that you need to respond to, and you go ahead and do that research. And then you want to sit down and write an outline of the sorts of things that you're going to want to say at oral argument, knowing that you're not going to get a chance to actually go up there and give a presentation or say all these things. And most people write out an opening statement, and they frequently write out many of them, and try them out on different people and see how they work. The most important, I think most people think that the most important thing you can do in preparation for an oral argument is moot courts, which I don't know if you guys do moot courts to prepare for your moot courts or not, but they are exceedingly helpful. And, you know, in this Roberts article, he explained what his practice was to do three of them. The very first one, you don't do that much preparation for, what the purpose of it is not to give perfect answers, but instead to find out what the big questions are. And the benefit of a moot court frequently is that you're going to bring people in to read the briefs and ask you questions who have not been involved in the case thus far and who are thus much more like the justices from their perspective. And they frequently will ask you questions that would never have occurred to you, but it can be very good ones and are very likely to be thought up by the court. And so that's the major purpose of the first one, is to try out major, kind of general approaches and to figure out what the questions are. And then the second moot, he said, is used to kind of more fine-tune, to kind of settle on a major approach, try it out. And then the third one is actually the dress rehearsal. That's the point at which you need to have answers for every question. The point there is to practice the articulation of your responses, not to be still fiddling around with the substance of what you're going to say. To that end, and I should say, in the Solicitor General's office, for example, they do two moot courts, and other practitioners. I have an argument coming up at the end of the month. I'm going to do three. I know some people. We were co-counsel in the Hamdan case, and the lawyer who argued that case, I think, did 13 of them, which is crazy, I think, but he got a lot of input, and he won the case. The other thing that a lot of people do, and somebody like me needs to do, is to actually write down the articulations of your most basic points. So the most important things that you need to say succinctly and clearly, or the things that are the most difficult to say succinctly and clearly. If it's difficult to think of the best way to say something on your feet, the way to avoid having to do that is to think about it ahead of time, write it down, memorize it. You don't always say it exactly that way, but for somebody like me, it's important because I'm not naturally an eloquent person. Somebody like Tom, who folks who, if you've heard him speak, you know, he doesn't have to do that because, you know, he's a much, you know, more eloquent person, but you know, you need to figure out for your own self what you need to do in order to get where you need to be by the time of argument. And then I and a lot of people then just spend a lot of time in a room by yourself practicing saying things, practicing your answers, practicing your spiel, practicing, you know, what your presentation would look like if, in fact, you were uninterrupted. And a lot of people actually in their first moots will ask the participants not to ask any questions for like 15 minutes to let you go ahead and just get practice saying things, and then start over and then have people ask questions and to get feedback about what, you know, what you said back when you weren't interrupted. Let me finish by talking just briefly about the mechanics. I know some people have questions about what do you bring up to the podium with you and things like that. It depends. For example, one of the things you need to know at the Supreme Court is that their podium is not big enough to hold a legal tablet. It'll fall off if you try to bring a legal tablet up there, so you need to bring smaller pieces of paper. In general, it varies what people bring up there. Some people, some very brave people, or some people with photographic memories, bring nothing at all. David Boyce, who argued on the Vice President Gore's behalf in Bush versus Gore, is somebody who has one of these photographic memories, never brings anything up, and then they can just spout off, you know, subsections of regulations off the top of his head. I am not somebody who can do that, and so one of the things that I bring up with me actually is just a list of the sites for, like, the major regulations and the major statutes that might come up, just so I can glance down at them and make sure that I'm giving the right numbers when I'm talking about something. Because I should mention, one of the most effective things you can do in an oral argument when you're talking about something like a statute or a regulation or a piece of the record is give the cite, but also point to where in the documents before the court can find them if it wants to look at them right there on the spot. And so frequently what I will have is a chart that says, okay, here's, you know, the reasonable accommodations regulations, here's the cite in the CFR, here's where it's reproduced in our brief, so I can cite them to the page on that, and here's the major thing I want to say about it, if it comes down to it. And some people do that with cases and case sites and stuff like that too. Again, it depends on, you know, what's going to be the focus of your case and what you can remember and what you won't. You know, I bring an outline up there with the major points that I want to make and with the citations that support those points. I almost never look at them, and in fact, most people who bring things up to the podium with them don't look at them because there simply isn't time, and you don't really want to because it really is distracting to the justices for you to. And maybe you've seen me do this tonight because I'm not as terribly well prepared for this as one might hope. It really is distracting when I'm looking down here at this piece of paper rather than making eye contact with you. And similarly, I should note, you know, I just told you a lot of folks, and Tom is one of these people, he makes a point of pointing out where in the red brief you can read this along with me. Chief Justice Roberts in his practitioner's article actually said that's not a great idea because it can... I think the quote is, justices are better readers than they are listeners, and that if you get them reading something, they may continue to read and stop listening to you. So it's something to think about. And then finally, you know, they're just basic things. You need to speak slowly. It's a problem for a lot of people. It's a problem for me. When I get nervous, or particularly when I feel pressed for time, I talk quickly. I mean, I have to make a conscious effort to slow down. I also have to make a conscious effort to speak up and to make sure my mouth is close to this microphone because I have a low voice and I don't have a very dynamic speaking style, and so it's, you know, I'll put people asleep if I don't make an effort at speaking up. Other people, there are some people who need to make an effort to keep their mouth away from the microphone because they naturally talk so loudly they're going to, you know, bug the crap out of the justices because all their P's and their B's are going to be spitting on the microphone. And these other basic things. Avoid distracting movements with your hands while you're up there. You know, it makes a more engaging presentation maybe in something like this, but I think the general consensus is in a court, frequently you should do what I'm doing right now, is have your hands up here clasping the podium. It looks somewhat natural. It keeps you from putting your hands in your pockets or playing with your pen. Anything that you do that distracts the justices is a bad thing. By the same token, notwithstanding what you may have learned from watching Ally McBeal, while your opponent's up there, you should not be doing distracting things either. You should suppress the urge to make faces when your opponent makes outrageous claims and tells big lies about you and what you said in your brief. You shouldn't be twiddling your thumb. More commonly, because you'll frequently have co-counsel up at the bench, there can be whispering going on among people, passing notes, and stuff like that. And that can be very distracting, and it's just rude. So you should try to keep that down to a minimum. Finally, I'm going to mention, just to keep things in perspective, and maybe this is not the best advice for a moot court where, you know, you want to keep thinking that this is totally important. Remember this res judicata case that we keep going back to. That guy, in fact, won the case. And I tell you that, and in fact, it got so bad at one point where Justice Scalia said to him, "Now, counsel, for me to rule in your favor, don't I simply have to say X?" And I was here at this oral argument. And the guy looks at him, and it's clear he has no idea what X means. He doesn't understand the first thing about what these justices have been saying to him for half an hour. But what he says to Justice Scalia is, "Justice Scalia, you can rule in my favor on any ground you want." And that's what they did. And that's how it should be. The Supreme Court recognizes it's making law for the entire country, and just because some bumbling bad lawyer gets up there and does a bad job shouldn't mean that the court decides the case wrongly. And so while we have an obligation as lawyers to assist the court to the best of our ability and to represent our clients as well as we can, at the end of the day, you can rest assured that unless you really, really screw things up, it's unlikely that you're going to lose the case at oral argument because of your malpractice or screw up the law for everybody else. Questions? Well, and it didn't, in fact. I mean, what they ended up doing is saying, we're not going to decide whether that is a good argument or not. We're just going to set that aside and say, because you didn't make that argument, you lose. And that'll happen sometimes. I think it's more frequently that, I mean, I think what happened in that case is not simply that, they felt forced to do what they did, but it allowed Justice O'Connor to rule that the way she did without, or to vote that the way she did, without foreclosing what she thought was perhaps a more sensible result for a future case. Yes, sir. No. The justices, the judges, particularly in courts of appeals, very much appreciate it when you sit down. And sometimes, in courts of appeals, because they frequently hear arguments in easy cases, particularly some circuits will hear argument in any case where one of the parties asks for it, it's really a giant waste of everybody's time. And the court is very appreciative if you just say what you have to say and then sit down so they can get to lunch early. And frequently, as a practical matter, you run the risk of, if you keep talking, reminding them of some problem they haven't thought of in your case or something that they wanted to ask you about that's not going to put your case in the best light. And so you heard in that death penalty case and in Lonchar, Don Verley got up for his rebuttal and just said, if there are no further questions, and then he got a question. Now, that's a good way to go about it, because you do want to have available to you at rebuttal the opportunity to respond to any really important lingering questions that somebody might have. Now, Justice Stevens' question wasn't that important, but it's perfectly appropriate and a good idea, if you've said all that you need to say, particularly if it looks like you're winning the case, to, you know, sit down. Yes, ma'am. It depends very much on whether it matters. If it's an important thing, then it's quite appropriate to say, you know, Justice O'Connor, you know, that's in fact not correct, you know, and you better be right about it. And it's much better to say that's not in fact correct if you look at the, you know, it sort of came up in the question to Verrilli where she said the 11th Circuit held that this was his motivation. Is that right? I mean, she wasn't really saying it herself, but had she just said, you know, here's what is subjective motivation, it would be perfectly appropriate for him to say, well, that's not in fact correct, Justice O'Connor. If you look at the district court's opinion, it's reproduced in the appendix at 7A, the court says, in fact, this. And you can, as long as you do it respectfully, the court appreciates it. Anybody else? Yes, sir. Well, let's separate two things. One is if you don't actually legitimately understand what has been asked of you, it's perfectly to say, I'm sorry, Justice Scalia, can you repeat the hypothetical? Or I didn't catch that. On the other hand, if you just can't figure out where it's going, you can't really say, well, I understand what your question is, but I don't know what you're getting at. You know, you've got to just answer, you got to answer straight up the hypothetical. One thing you can't do, and let me say two more things about hypotheticals. One is, and you saw Maureen Mahoney do this, in answering the hypothetical, sometimes if you're worried about some ambiguity in it, you can, as long as you're careful, supply the missing information. So remember, she said, well, if in fact, you know, UCLA, you, I don't remember which school it was, UCLA had this minimum goal and they wouldn't change it no matter how, no matter what the applicant pool looked like and blah, blah, blah. And she added these additional things that weren't in the hypothetical that then allowed her to say, yes, that would be unconstitutional, while being confident that that's not giving away her case. And that's one thing you can do. Frequently, if there's a missing piece that's material to the answer, you can. It's fair to say, well, Justice Scalia, if, in fact, A, then the answer is this, and if, in fact, B, then the answer is that. You need to say that quickly, though, so that he understands that you're answering both things and not bucking the hypothetical by just asserting some friendly fact in there to you. But the final thing, and this should be obvious, is it's very rare that it's appropriate to ask a justice a question. They're there to ask you questions. You're not there to ask them questions. And they can take offense if you do. Pretty much, you know, I'm sorry I didn't understand that is the closest you can get. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.